This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, September 9th, 2012. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, who to call if having a personal crisis. And we talk about the Ozark dialect. But first...
This week, we begin a series of reports on those daily occurrences we might not think about until there's a disruption in service. You put out the trash in the morning, and it's taken away by the time you're back. When it comes to everyday things that it's easy to take for granted, turning on the tap for water can be near the top. Decades since the passage of the Safe Drinking Water Act, most Americans can reasonably assume the water from their sink is safe. In Fort Smith, there is a collection of laboratories dedicated to making sure that's the case.
We're in the hallway that divides the five laboratories that we have.
Lance McAvoy is the environmental manager at Fort Smith Utilities Environmental Quality Analytical Laboratory.
This laboratory is the metals laboratory. We have a microbiology laboratory, a wet chemistry laboratory, a special equipment laboratory, and a biology laboratory.
This hallway is clean and quiet. An occasional person in a white lab coat enters one of the five labs. Inside those labs are tests to make sure the water residents drink, cook with, or simply come into contact with is safe.
This is our microbiology laboratory. We're one of only a handful of laboratories certified by the health department to analyze drinking water samples for bacteria.
So if a boil order is enacted for a neighborhood in Fort Smith, the water from that neighborhood will be tested here. Since the utility's environmental quality analytical lab is state-of-the-art, the scientists here often test water from other cities as well. Lance McAvoy says they've tested water from Fayetteville, Russellville, and as far south as Mena. Though they test the water, the lab cannot lift a boil order, nor can a city. Only the state health department has that authority, but it can be based on the findings from a lab like this one. These tests are a combination of hands-on work and cutting-edge technology. Lance McAvoy collects a few vials of contaminated water that he uses to explain a test for tap water quality.
It's a 100-mil sample every time. The sample is then brought to room temperature.
A powdered media is added to and dissolved in the water. The sample is incubated in a 35-degree water bath for 24 hours, and if the sample comes out clear...
Then it's negative for total coliform growth and E. coli. If the sample comes out yellow, it's total coliform growth.
Then the lights go out, and he grabs a handheld fluorescent lamp.
Then we check it for fluorescence using a long wave UV, and you'll see that this one fluoresces, kind of a bluish color. Well, that means it's positive for E. coli.
It's more than black lights and water baths here, of course. Recent advances in technology have produced tabletop machines and computers that can sample water from the tap or out of a waterway for contaminants in very, very small amounts, parts per billion and smaller. In the metals lab, where water can be tested for such things as lead content, that technology is on display inside.
An inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer. We refer to it as an ICP mass spec because it's not as big of a mouthful.
This unit takes a water sample and turns it into a fine mist in what's called the nebulizer.
Then that's going into an argon plasma, and that plasma is at 10,000 Kelvin. That's roughly the surface temperature of the sun. That breaks down all the organics that might be left and gets rid of the water. Then each individual ion, isotope, goes into the detector, and it's measuring the weight of each isotope. So for lead, there are three abundant isotopes, 206, 207, 208. Every time it hits, it notices something hitting at 206, it knows that that's lead, 207, 208. Then it can actually add those together and give you a total lead, or it can actually say, okay, I want to know uranium-238 over uranium-235. It can look at 238 and 235 and show you the ratio. This will measure down in part per trillion detection limit. We normally run it in a mode for part per billion.
20 years ago, Lance says, detecting metals at a part per billion was considered amazing. Now, it's the standard. He says the labs in Fort Smith can test 10 parts per trillion. The newer machinery can also test faster and overnight, allowing for more efficient and faster test results. If a problem is found in one of the random tests, the lab team then has to investigate. A bad sample means they'll have to consider sample collection errors or a problem in the process. They'll return to the same spot and get more samples.
We collect a sample from that location, and then we collect a sample, what's called upstream and downstream, looking at the flow. So it may be one or two service connections over, no more than five, and say that the site itself is the only one that keeps coming back positive. Then we know that there's something about that location, that house. They may have a cross connection or some type of backflow, which we really then start investigating, because that could, again, get into the distribution system.
While the tests conducted here can be complaint-driven, that's hardly all that's happening inside the labs. It's a seven-day-a-week operation.
We like to say that from the time the rain hits the ground and runs into the stream, into the reservoirs, the treatment plant, the collection system, and out of your tap, back into the collection system, into the wastewater plant, and then actually into the river. We actually test the river as well to make sure that what we're discharging isn't affecting it. We're testing the whole way through.
The work inside the labs is only part of the story. Many of the people here, like Don Clover, wade into the water around the region to bring back samples for regular testing. Don also brings back insects for examination.
One thing about the insect larvae, they're always there all the time. You go out and if you get a water sample, it gives you an idea of the water quality at that moment. It's a picture of the water quality. Insects are there day in and day out. They don't go on vacation or anything. They're always there. So if you're able to go out and actually collect samples of these and bring them back and ID them, then they'll give you an idea just merely by the presence or the absence of different types. You will get a good idea really of basically of the water quality.
Sure, they're there all the time.
They're there all the time, yes.
The afternoon, Don and Lance were discussing their work. The remnants of Hurricane Isaac were approaching. The wind had picked up and a light sprinkle was falling. The forecast at the time warned of heavy local rainfall totals. Lance McAvoy, the environment manager at the labs, says the staff gears up a bit for such storms, since flash flooding can mean broken lines or other troubles. In fact, storms hundreds of miles away can create extra work in Fort Smith. 7 years ago, when Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, the lab worked overtime.
We actually spent our Labor Day weekend testing samples from the U.S. Forest Service. They have these gigantic potable water tanks that they were taking down to the area to supply fresh water. Fort Smith was a staging area. They brought all these in from out west because they didn't have really a wildfire problem back then. But all of those had to be certified as clean. So at that time I was a lab manager, and I spent probably 12, 18 hours a day, 3 days, testing that so that they could get water down, because clean drinking water is the difference between life and death.
The cost of an average gallon of water, according to the Fort Smith Utility Department, is less than a penny per gallon. You can learn more about the city's water and read water quality reports for the city for the past 12 years at fortsmithwater.org.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And with us is Katie Hendrickson, host of Note during the week and on Sundays, Sunday Symphonies.
How are you guys doing?
Good. Busy week, but good.
Yes, absolutely. Well, last week we had symphonies that went from Haydn to Hovannis, so it spanned a lot of time. I picked three symphonies out that I thought went well together. They just all happened to be written right in the height of World War II. They're all 20th century symphonies.
So 1940s?
Wow. One was completed in 1939, one was completed in 1940 and 42. So it's Rachmaninoff, Arnold Bax, and Martineau. So we've got Russian, a British guy, and a Czechoslovakian.
It's interesting because I'm only speaking for myself. Often when I hear the word symphony, I don't think 20th century. You know, I'm thinking Haydn or
Bach,
right.
Bach really isn't known as a symphonic composer. But we would think of Beethoven is
right.
Who we would think of.
And then it's nice to
Mozart.
Remember, yeah, that Rachmaninoff.
And then you think of the later Romantics, and you think of Schubert and Schumann and all those people, Mahler.
Right.
But then past that, it gets a little blurry,
right.
Or less. But I mean, I did have, let's see, Ives and Hovannis last
right.
time. So, but this time they all happened. Let's see, the Rachmaninoff, it's his last composition ever. It's his symphonic dances. Arnold Bax, it's his last symphony number 7. But for Martineau, it's his very first symphony.
Oh, that's a nice juxtaposition there. Kind of a passing of the torch.
Yeah. I have a question about they were all written during World War II. And, you know, I mean, and around Europe, can you tell that that was a tense time in the world through this music?
Well, actually, two of the composers actually wrote their pieces while they were in exile in the United States. Well, Rachmaninoff wrote his in New York, and Martin New was, gosh, I don't have my notes on where he was when he wrote it, but he emigrated to the U.S. in 1941 to escape what was going on in World War II. Arnold Bax was, he was born in into money. He never had to worry about anything, and he was in Scotland composing and doing his own thing during World War II, so it didn't seem to have much of an influence on his work.
So three of them tonight. Do you know at this point yet which order they'll go in?
Yes, actually, I put Arnold Bax will be first, followed by Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances, and then Martin New's First Symphony will be the last.
All right. Uninterrupted Symphonies tonight on Sunday Symphonies at 7?
Yes.
And then you're back tomorrow morning at 11 with Of Note?
Yes.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. The University of Arkansas, UA Fort Smith, Northwest Arkansas Community College, and several area public schools all were in the news this week. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has some of the highlights in his Week in Review.
This past week has been full of stories about education. On Friday, we learned that the Springdale School District did well on its end-of-course benchmark exams last year. Marcia Jones is the district's Director of Curriculum, Instruction, and Accountability.
As we were able to analyze our benchmark performance this year, we saw every grade in literacy and all grades, with the minor exception of math, slipping just a slight bit. Every grade was moving upward in its total of percent proficient and advanced, and we're closing the gap within our subpopulations towards meeting those expectations as well. So we're really proud of the work that our students and our teachers did to get these scores of numbers of students proficient or advanced going the right direction.
Jones says that while literacy scores were up across the board, math benchmark scores were down in some areas. But she seemed undaunted as she explained how the district handles unfavorable scores.
Anytime we have an area that is showing a negative or not a gain like we'd like, we put an extra focus there to see what the issues are. Last year, for example, we looked specifically at eighth grade math scores, and in that area we got double digit increase. Same true with our science. We saw a double digit increase in the seventh grade there simply because the teachers and the students put more emphasis on particular learning. So anytime that occurs, we're going to give it immediate attention.
In addition, she says that implementation of Common Core standards this year will naturally help raise test scores.
That's going to place more rigor into the classrooms. So the level of mathematics is increased in every grade. The level of reading complexity, the level of the Lexile score is increasing, what's required to be on grade level. So there's quite a bit of increased rigor, which ought to positively impact as well.
But lesson plans and test scores are only one part of the picture. With unparalleled growth in the region, the need for expanding physical facilities will gradually become as apparent as the need for expanding the curriculum. Last Monday, we talked with Michael Poore, the superintendent of Bentonville Schools. The Bentonville School Board recently approved plans to expand classroom space at four elementary schools in the district.
This really was needed because it's kind of one of those pleasant problems, a problem that many districts probably would love to have, but we ended up having over 1,000 new students come into Bentonville Schools this year. We'd projected for only 500, and really, that had been kind of our track mark of having 400 to 600 new kids. This year we had 1,000 new kids. And immediately when we got those kids, and kindergarten group in particular is at a very high number, it made it so that we have no margin anymore. And we're actually transporting kids this year across 3 and 4 attendance zones to get to a school where there is room.
Poore says that the expansions, which he hopes to be complete by the beginning of next school year, will have tangible benefits. Aside from giving the district more breathing room for growth, he says that the additional space will allow the district to keep students at schools closer to their neighborhoods, which in turn will help cut down on transportation costs. The school board also approved plans to upgrade technology across the district.
Our technology need is still long-term in terms of what we have to do planning out, but we didn't want to waste another year and fall even farther behind other surrounding districts. This allocation of resources will allow us to become wireless in all of our buildings, something that we currently don't have. It will enhance computer labs at all of our sites. And then finally, it'll help us with infrastructure needs in order to be able to support these enhanced things so that our technology, you know, will be efficient and running and serving kids.
The technology upgrades were originally proposed in June as part of a millage increase for a new high school. Voters rejected the millage increase, and while some may wonder why the $7 million that will go towards these new expansion plans isn't going toward expanding the current high school, Poor says that reason is simple. Because of state guidelines governing class sizes, the maximum class size in elementary schools is smaller than that in high schools.
But we have more flexibility in terms of what we can do with those high school kids in terms of schedules, as well as what we can even do with teachers on assignments. In the past, let's say 5 years ago in Bentonville, a teacher might be teaching in their classroom for 5 hours during the day and then have 1 hour where they're in a planning period. Well, now that doesn't happen in Bentonville. I mean, everybody basically is on carts. Well over 50% of our staff are on carts and moving, and we're using every single room.
And if schools are growing at the primary and secondary education levels, one could reasonably expect larger enrollment numbers in higher education. However, there is no guarantee. While enrollment dipped around 3% this year at Northwest Arkansas Community College and at the University of Arkansas in Fort Smith, enrollment grew at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville by around 6%. The university recently announced that nearly 24,600 students are enrolled this fall semester. As with enrollment increases in primary and secondary education, more students means more learning space is needed. On Thursday, the Buildings and Grounds Committee of the UA System's Board of Trustees recommended the construction of a new building at the Fayetteville campus. The building, to be built on West Dixon Street, would provide additional classroom and laboratory space to help the college keep pace with enrollment growth. But UA Chancellor G. David Gerhart says that book studies shouldn't be the only area of focus for developing a well-rounded individual.
If math and science are the means by which we enrich our economy through job creation and technological innovation, then the arts are the means by which we enrich our spirits. A healthy, vibrant community finds balance in both and values both. Beyond providing learning opportunities for students, public art and public performance have been cited in several studies as key factors in recruiting and retaining the professional workforce tied to the expansion of the knowledge-based economy.
He was speaking at a press conference Wednesday, during which it was announced that Jim and Joyce Faulkner of Little Rock had donated $6 million to convert the old field house at the Fayetteville campus into a state-of-the-art performing arts center.
As we have said many times, the University of Arkansas is committed to being a top 50 research university by 2021, if not earlier. We know a much greater commitment to the arts will be necessary to accomplish this.
Chancellor Gerhart said that the center will be yet another selling point to convince potential students to come to the U of A.
Performing in an arts center like the one we envision will be a dream come true for thousands of future students. And I want to particularly thank again the students for being here today, because this is being done for you.
When construction is complete, students performing in the center will join a long list of people who've performed in the building in the past, including Chuck Berry, Louis Armstrong, and even Ray Charles. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now are Melody Kuchabaugh and Jenny Kirstein with the Arkansas Crisis Center. The coming week is National Suicide Prevention Week, and that's sort of what the Arkansas Crisis Center does, right?
Yes.
Okay. What is the mission of the Crisis Center?
We restore hope, empower people,
and save lives throughout the state of Arkansas through crisis intervention services and trainings and suicide prevention.
So before we got started, you were kind of telling me a little bit about the, you know, statistics.
Nationwide, death by suicide is the 10th leading cause. You know, there's 100 suicides approximately throughout the nation every single day, or every 14 minutes someone dies by suicide in the United States.
And the age group, it's more prevalent with
25 to 34. Suicide is actually the second leading cause of death in the nation. Ages 10 through 24, it's the third leading cause. And in ages 35 to 54, it's the fourth leading cause. So it's pretty significant.
It is significant. When you think car wrecks and, I mean, disease.
Sure,
and
sure, absolutely. In the age group of 15 to 24 and 25 to 34, suicide is more prevalent than all cancers combined.
We were discussing earlier that it's not always just, you know, there's usually underlying issues. It's not just because, you know, somebody lost their job, or it's not just because of that one event. There's, you know, usually depression and mental illness.
Yes. A lot of times, you know, we define crisis, and we do crisis intervention.
Okay.
We talk about suicide a lot, but the Arkansas Crisis Center is focused on crisis intervention because the crisis is anything that has the ability to overwhelm someone. And that's different for each person. You know, in particular, I always talk about a young person who fails a test. Well, that doesn't sound huge to you and I, but maybe that test is what rested their whole academic career. That one F is going to not allow them to get that scholarship to go to that school. Their parents can't afford it. Their parents have been fighting about money lately. So, you know, each crisis builds upon itself until they reach the point where they're so overwhelmed they don't necessarily know where to turn or what to do. So we're very intentional when we talk about it that you can't or I or anybody shouldn't define what a crisis is for someone, because we don't know what else is building on top of that. You know, a lot of times it's easy to realize that if someone files bankruptcy, well, that we can add weight to because it sounds weighty. You recognize it as a crisis.
Crisis center, you are there to answer phone calls, right?
Mm-hmm. For yes.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yes, ma'am, 365 days a year. We have a 24-hour, 7 days a week crisis line. Hotline, it's an 800 number, 888 number, actually. It's staffed, in particular, through volunteers, very well-trained crisis intervention specialists, as well as staff at some points, and we are always available in the midst of a crisis. Everybody that staffs the crisis line has gone through a very extensive training, and we have one volunteer that's actually been with our agency for 22 years. So there are a lot of people out there that are dedicated to providing crisis intervention services to those in need. We're always looking for more volunteers. Another way that we have really hooked in and tried to provide services to those in need is through the online crisis chat. And so those are the two services that we provide to the people in need necessarily. Now we have a lot of educational programs.
So a phone call comes in, and it's a trained volunteer answering the phone. So do they just, I mean, they're just kind of there to talk?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but they're,
you know. They're there to talk. They have some special skills. We do have policies and procedures and imminent risk type activities, but basically it's there to let somebody vent and release, you know, because sometimes they don't have anybody to talk to, or they're scared to talk to, or they don't want to talk to their parents or their friends or that counselor or the teacher or their spouse, you know, to really tell them where they are, where, what they're thinking and what they're feeling. As much as it's a taboo in our society to talk about suicide, there's a lot of guilt associated with somebody thinking about it too, because they're, especially if they're in a planning stage, they're realizing to some extent the potential for negative impact, whether it be to their family or friends or, you know, even their workplace. So a lot of times what you find is once somebody can talk about it and can talk through it and can vent and express all the emotions with no judgment to somebody that a lot of times at that point they are settled to the point where they're ready to explore other options, other avenues for help, other ways to deal with what's going on in their lives.
And so at that point, do you connect them with other resources in
Absolutely.
The community?
Mm-hmm.
How many phone calls do you get in a day, a month, a year?
Well, in 2011, we had almost 10,000 calls to the crisis line and through online chat. This year, in just through the month of August, we're now in September, through the month of August, we're right around 6,000.
Well, what can just the general population do? I mean, it's Suicide Prevention Week. You know, what can I do as, you know, a friend, girlfriend,
and
daughter?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we talked about it. In our society, this is taboo. You know, having experienced suicide in my family, it took me a while to actually physically be able to talk about it and be comfortable with it. But for the average person who thinks they might know somebody or who might be in danger of, or who just wants to reach out and help somebody else that they don't even know, I mean, there's different ways that you can help. And definitely maybe doing just getting online and looking at our website. You know, we have basic information about it, basic information about our agency. You can always call us and do some volunteer work. You can be trained and get on the hotlines, and you can actually help somebody who's in southeastern Arkansas. But at the same time, I mean, it could just be reaching out and saying, hey, I know somebody who might be in danger of hurting themselves. What do I need to do as this person? And you can actually get a little bit more information as to how to handle that situation.
How do you know, though? You know, like, you hear that, you know, people that have committed suicide and or attempted, and the people around them are like, well, I didn't see the warning signs.
Well,
are there warning signs?
There are. There are some people that you just think maybe that's just a mood swing, or maybe that's just they're having a rough day. But those rough days become more often, and it happens more frequently, and their behavior changes and their reaction to those moods. And really, I think for me, I would say that some of the big signs are talking less, their behavior changing around you, their constant communication, if it decreases, if they... you know, or if they become on the complete opposite side where they're talking more, it's becoming euphoric almost, where they're overly happy, they're overly exerted, you know, that they start giving things away, that they start talking about plans that aren't really common, you know, that aren't things that they would have ever talked about before, or just even some morbid questions, like, you know, where, have you thought about death before? How would you want to die? Kind of, it's very strange, but to get out of their normal behavior is something to really look at.
Jenny, you not only work for the Arkansas Crisis Center. As you mentioned, you are a survivor of suicide.
Correct.
Coming up at the end of the month, you have a memorial run for your...
I do. It's called Run for Every Chris. This is our second annual event. Last year, you know, was our inaugural year. It was a great success, so we're definitely bringing it back. But Chris is actually... This run is for my older brother. He was 15. I was 13. You know, and I have spent most of my life without him than I did with him. And a couple years ago, I had gotten to the point where I was, like, emotionally secure. I was, you know, confident and capable of talking about it. I was to the point where I needed to help and give back to the community, especially the suicide community. And I knew that this was a great way. I'm an avid runner, and I thought there's no other way to get his memory out, to help others, and to do exactly what I love and combine them all together. So September 29th at Lake Fayetteville Veterans Memorial Park, we have a 10K trail run, and we have a 5K fun run walk, and that's on the pavement. And we've got great sponsors. Signature Bank is our presenting sponsor, and they are cooking food for us. We have live music, but it is a great atmosphere. to have everyone come. And it's not somber event. It's, it's a great event. Everyone has a great energy. A lot of people come out. It's a friends and family environment. We definitely aren't going to like pressure you to talk about anything, but we want you to come and join us and kind of have that fellowship of people who have common experiences that know what you've gone through. And whether or not you tell us, we will be more than happy to welcome you and join you and get you some information. We have great goodie bags, by the way, so you want to leave with the swag bag. Yeah. This is the one you want to leave with. So,
well, I am not an avid runner. I've been kind of dabbling in it for the last 9 months or so.
Oh, you can walk, but, too.
Well, yeah, well, my goal, Fayetteville Half in December.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking 10K at the end of the month.
That'll be golden
Might
for you.
Might be a good... And the week before?
And the week before is actually the Charity Challenge of Champions. It is in its 21st year, so this is a long-standing event. It's a tennis and golf tournament up at Pinnacle. And we have different social events that anyone can come in and buy a ticket to. On Friday night, September 21st, is our silent auction, live auction gala. It's $100 at the door, but all the proceeds for both events go to the Arkansas Crisis Center. So no matter what you think this is happening, we are a nonprofit all the way around, and we just want to earn and raise as much money as possible to give back to this agency, just to keep us around and to keep helping as many people as possible. So even with Run for Every Chris, all the proceeds go straight to the Crisis Center. So,
all right. Well, people can find out more about both of these events, and I mean, there's a lot of information out there. I mean, to volunteer for training.
Yeah, we
and
always.
And for help.
Yes.
Where can they go?
They can go to www.arcrisis.org. That's okay. Probably the easiest and the best. Or you can always call our toll free number, 1-888-274-7472 or 1-888-CRISIS-2. Another thing I want to be sure to mention, too, if you are a survivor of suicide, we do have a support group for us. It's called SOS, Survivors of Suicide Support Group, here in Northwest Arkansas. You can always reach out to either the website or call the phone to get information about it.
And you guys are really doing a lot.
Well, we try.
For sure. Well, thank you, ladies.
Thank you so much. Yeah. We appreciate it.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Earlier this week, Antoinette Grajeda and I sat down with Dan Kraft, special projects reporter from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers, to talk about an article in today's paper. Here is that conversation. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Visiting us again in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Dan Kraft, a special projects reporter from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Thanks for coming back.
Anytime.
A story that is running this Sunday in all the editions of Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Loot, stuff, found, seized.
All sorts
seized.
Of cool
seized.
Stuff.
Not found, seized
all
by...
Found and seized.
It was found, and then they decided, you're a drug dealer, we're law enforcement, you're going to jail, and we're just going to grab your stuff. Because it was used in drug dealing, and now we want it.
So when you say stuff, you don't just mean the drugs.
They've got drugs, cash, guns, cars.
So you can just take someone's car. I mean, I understand removing the drugs because it's an illegal substance and getting that off the street or whatever, but, like, the car?
They can prove that the car was used in your drug dealing business, yeah, they can seize it. Now, of course, if you've got a brand-new Cadillac Escalade, let's say, and they want to grab it because you're going to prison, but the dealership still has a $40,000 lien out on the truck, it's going back to the dealership.
Gotcha.
Oh, I see.
However, if it's paid for, they're probably going to grab that Cadillac and either keep it and use it, undercover car, you know, give it to someone else to use for something, or they'll auction it off and keep the cash.
Kind of a bit of recycling there.
Right.
So,
what if the car is in my name, but somebody, not stolen, because obviously that, but someone who I'm related to or who I know,
was
I let them use
it,
but I did not have the knowledge that they were using it.
Well, they can't just go in, arrest you, put the cuffs on, and grab your car keys. They do have to go through a court order, forfeiture, and seizure documentation. And in your case, your car would probably be returned to you.
Okay. Did you find out if law enforcement agencies, are they more likely to try to get the recent model car than, say, my 1975
Buick?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Depends on what kind of undercover work they're doing. A 75 Buick might be kind of nice.
Yeah, I see.
It really does depend on what they think they can get out of it or what kind of use they think they have for it.
So cars, cash, you mentioned.
Yep.
Anything else?
Cell phones or jewelry?
The phones
like
you're not going to get a whole lot out of. They usually grab the phones mostly so that they can get warrants and check and see who you've been calling or texting so that they can further their investigation. One guy up in Benton County back in January or February, they arrested him for selling large amounts of marijuana. And they took, I believe, 2 motorcycles, 4 cars, a jet ski, and a pontoon boat. Oh, and one of those side-by-side utility mules.
Because
when we
things...
read it, we thought, why did they grab a mule? We were thinking of the live one.
Oh, no, no.
Oh.
No.
But because all those things were in that guy's name, I guess.
They were.
If something is seized and it's sold, are there any taxes paid on that? Do you know?
Basically, what happens is the money goes back into the same fund that the cash they grabbed off the dealer would go into, and that's it's called a drug control fund. The prosecutor's offices actually administer that fund, and they'll divvy out money to the various agencies that were involved in that bust. They keep some of it to buy specialized equipment, whether it's new undercover cars for those the drug task force, your narcotics detectives for city and county police agencies.
Could you seize a house?
You could. They don't do it often. Real estate, they don't have any good use for, really, and in this economy it's kind of hard to flip, so they generally don't. Some of the cars, even some of the guns, they do keep. Some agencies automatically destroy any gun they get. Others, if they have a nice, say, AR-15 tactical rifle, that's one of the guns they got off this same dealer in Benton County. One of the captains now carries that rifle. It was seized and issued to him. It's a $1,200 weapon that the office doesn't have to buy another officer.
And you mentioned that they can sell these things, so like I could go buy some of these things at auction.
They'll hire a private auction company, and the items they don't want to keep will be thrown in the same auction with the used road department trucks and the old squad cars they're getting rid of, and they'll all be sold at the same time. So, yeah, it's the same county auction you normally see advertisements for.
I know this has nothing to do with your story, but they auction off old police cars?
They do, when they're done using them.
Uh-huh.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've seen people driving them, so I know they had to get them from somewhere.
But I thought those cars could go faster than your average car.
Oh, they can.
Do they then modify them or slow them?
No, they're modified out of the factory. You get a high mileage and very worn out, but still pretty capable rig.
Huh, about that. They've taken the lights and all that off.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, your story about the seizures of booty from criminal activity, that's in Sunday's paper.
It is.
Thank you, Dan.
Appreciate it, guys.
Dan Kraft is Special Projects Reporter for Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Do you speak Ozark English? Scholars say it's a distinct dialect rooted in Appalachia, tracing back to the British Isles. And like many endangered languages, it's fading. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, if you listen carefully, you can still hear Ozark English spoken.
Buster Austin is an Ozark native. He turns 100 in October. And when we spoke with him early this summer for a story about homesteading in Madison County, he told us when he was a boy growing up, he loved to climb a rock bluff on nearby Penitentiary Mountain.
I've climbed it where it's nearly as tall as the trees.
I've climbed it. That archaic usage is rare and precious to linguists studying regional dialects. Shiloh Museum of Ozark History's Susan Young, a fifth-generation Ozarker, studies on these things. She travels widely as outreach coordinator, delivering programs of all kinds, including on Ozark dialect. But when she's out in public, she's also perennially on the lookout for native speakers.
When I can hear somebody say, and I don't hear it very often, why dinner was plum lurpin', All right. There are two things in there. Dinner was plum larrapin. And dinner being the noon meal. Dinner is the noon meal. Larrapin is an old, old word for delicious.
Ozark English, she says, is mostly lost on Ozark urban districts. But in rural places?
People that live out in the rural areas that are living on the same land that they've lived on for generations, and grandpa and grandma might still live across the field from them. The traditions, including the dialect, just hangs on longer.
Especially in Newton County, in Madison County, what some of the locals call Booger County.
There are two favorite words that I use in my Ozark dialect program for kids. One is booger. You know what a booger is? Oh, my gosh. Well, yeah, after they all come back from pretending to pick their nose, a booger is a ghost or a scary creature or a haint or a haunt.
Also, the double negative, which is schooled out of us.
There's not nobody that I can think of that knows these Ozarks any better than I do. I don't know. Not nobody. There ain't nobody. Yet double negatives are very, very common. And again, I don't know why. I can just tell you that when I hear it, oh, yeah, it's like, okay, my people.
And the ubiquitous y'all?
Now, I grew up with y'all. And I say that all the time. It's just a normal way of speaking. But the more I've listened and the more I've talked to people here in the Ozarks, yuns is more historically accurate. Yuns. Yuns better come and go with us. I hear people that still say that today. That's a real lovely sound to me. Because I don't hear a lot of people that say yuns, and when that's real Ozark right there, yuns.
Her accent, she says, exemplifies the broader Highland Plateau dialect, distinct from the Arkansas River Valley and Delta. So where is she from exactly?
Fedvul, F-E-D-V-U-L. Now, let me say that the last thing I want to do, most of the programs that I get called upon to do have to do with traditional Ozark folkways. It's what people love to hear about, and that can be building a log cabin, quilting, moonshining, and the Ozark dialect. So all those things, moonshining and the Ozark dialect especially, are just dripping with our stereotype. You know, this accent that I have, people immediately think you're kind of dumb, like you're a hillbilly. I mean, it's not just my cross to bear. That's the whole, that's part of the Ozark stereotype, is the way we talk, or the Southern, the way we talk. Why, we must not have much book learning, or, you know, some of the wisest people I know sound like this.
But the thing is, Ozark English is rooted in Old English.
Travel writers and folklorists in the early 1900s especially made a big to-do about the Appalachians and the Ozarks having these remnants of an Anglo-Saxon seedbed, some of them would call it, and how you could go back in the hills of the Appalachians or in the Ozarks and find people talking the Elizabethan English, and that if you dropped William Shakespeare out of the sky and into this hill community, that he would be able to converse perfectly with the hill folk. And well, that's a little over-romanticized, because we didn't come from England and go straight to the Appalachians or the Ozarks. We had a chance to mix in on the East Coast with Germanic people and Scandinavian people. We had African Americans here with us as well. So it's not a perfectly intact Elizabethan English, but there are remnants of it, and there are a lot of scholars today that kind of poo-poo that and say that would say to me, "You're romanticizing this." But when I can pick out a word like salad that is in Shakespeare used the word salad. I can have a green salad. Well, I grew up here, and we're going to hunt for poke salad.
Whilst reckon, ain't, and purchase, to get a grip or purchase on something, all Anglo-Saxon. Pioneering folklorist John Lomax and his son Alan traveled the Mid and Deep South collecting songs, stories, and oral histories. But Susan says the rugged and remote Ozarks have been overlooked by such scholars. That's why the work of early to mid-20th century regional folklorists Vance Randolph, his spouse U of A English professor Mary Celestia Parler, and folklife writer Otto Ernest Rayburn is highly valued. Randolph, in particular, was keenly interested in the Ozark Highlands dialect, publishing a number of books which continue to sell to this day.
When Randolph was studying the Ozark folks, he purposely sought out the oldest members of a community that lived the furthest back in the hills, because he wanted to get those remnants of the old ways. He didn't go to the Chamber of Commerce and talk to the Chamber of Commerce president in Springfield, Missouri. He went to the folks back in the hills and hollers. So I think he had a fair, certainly his research is unparalleled as far as a regional focus on folkways of people. I also think, though, he knew how to sell books, and several of his books open up in the introduction with saying the Ozarks are the most deliberately unprogressive. The Ozark people are the most deliberately unprogressive people in the United States. And he knew that people had this, we had this yearning. We all have this yearning, I think, to go back to a simpler way of life, however you define that. And for so much of us, the American simpler way of life, historically, you think of the log cabin pioneers.
But it's Vance Randolph's spouse, Mary Celestia Parler, who's credited for being the most prolific Arkansas folklore researcher and recordist. Courtesy the Mary Celestia Parler Collection at Special Collections at the U of A in Fayetteville, here's a 1951 recording of Mary High Briscoe, a rural Carroll County native herbalist and folk singer, at the age of 76, talking about her grandpap being bewitched by 9 black cats.
And grandma had gone to bed, and every night they'd come in and dance around. 9 black cats would come and dance around the floor. And it was just a new house. And so he fixed him a chinking to fit that hole that they'd come in at every night. Here they come in dancing around, and before he could get that chunk in to save his neck, every one of them had gone out.
Now note the difference between Mary Briscoe, who lived close to Missouri, and this tape of Ivy Trail, archived in the Library of Congress American Folklife Center, recorded by Vance Randolph in 1942 in Farmington. Ivy's reading a letter she'd written to President Theodore Roosevelt requesting more medical services for her people.
There's some that says people can't make a living in the hills and ought to move out, but our mountain people are happy and they can raise stuff to eat, and they have lots of wood all around and plenty of pasture, and they get along all right, and they didn't kill them to be cooped up in town, and they don't ask no odds of nobody if it just wasn't for when sickness hits and things like that, why they can't get a doctor.
Other recordings of native Ozark English speakers reveal words like born, wanst, and twiced, and a comin' and a goin'. Again, Susan Young.
And I still hear that one quite a bit with the older folks in rural areas.
What it does is it's almost a verb.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of, I don't know if it's an extra emphasis, not necessarily.
Linguists measuring cognate matrices, one word across cultures, for example, mom, have a new theory that Indo-European languages can be traced to Anatolian culture, that's present-day Turkey. But given our cultural amalgamation, they say, by the end of the 21st century, the world will have lost as many as 7,000 languages. So the next time you hear someone speaking Ozark English, you ought to sit and listen for a spell, says fifth-generation Ozarks native Susan Young.
When you go to visit, like you're going on a Sunday afternoon, you're having dinner, you're having a noon meal with your old relatives, you sit and visit, and you might stay there all day. And then when you're done, you say, well, we better go, and they'll say, well, you might as well stay a while longer. You might as well stay more. And then your response is, well, you might as well come. You better come go with us. It's a way of saying goodbye. The people that are leaving will say, well, you better come go with us, while the people that are staying will say, well, you better stay more. So it's just a way of saying goodbye. And that's a lovely, lovely Ozark tradition.
Now, we plumb forgot at the end of our interview with Susan Young to ask her about the word drought, much discussed this summer on the Ozarks Plateau, because some tend to say the word drouth. Why is that? A search of the Cambridge History of English Language found the archaic usage, drouth, D-R-U-G-A-T-H, the Anglo-Saxon word for dryness. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Phillips.
It is Sunday, September 9th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Becca Martin Brown is with us. She is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm not sure Christine is old enough to remember the Beach Boys. I remember the Beach Boys, but I just mentioned it to you earlier.
You did. Yeah. Earlier today, we were talking about the Beach Boys. And here's the thing about the Beach Boys. I mean, they had a hit not that long ago, right? Kokomo?
That's true. Kinda was,
and they're still touring. They're out there on their 50th anniversary tour, right. So you don't have to remember them. They're still there.
Well, if you've missed the Beach Boys, you can see a band called Papa Do Run Run.
Mm-hmm.
It's got people who have played with the Beach Boys, people who have subbed in with them. Papa Do Run Run has opened for them, and they will be in Bella Vista this afternoon.
I remember that song.
The Do Run Run.
Mm-hmm. They also do music by the Doobie Brothers, Grand Funk Railroad, Jimmy Buffett, and Jan and Dean.
Yes.
What was that thought? That
well,
quite...
I take us off. So,
yes,
I was just
you do,
say,
but that's all right.
My nephew, John, who lives in New Orleans and is probably 11, when he stayed with us for a weekend, he looked at my CD collection, you know, thousands of CDs. You know which one he wanted a copy of?
The Beach Boys.
Yes.
Really?
Yep. And AC/DC.
Well, my daughter's a Beatles girl, but we could try some Beach Boys. Anyway, the band performs at 2 o'clock this afternoon at the Air and Art Center in Bentonville. It's part of the Live on Stage in Northwest Arkansas series, which is based in Bella Vista. Tickets are $30 for adults and $5 for students.
Yep.
Also this afternoon, ton of stuff. The Northwest Arkansas Gem and Mineral Society is wrapping up its Rock Swap from 10 to 4 at their clubhouse, North of Siloam Springs on Arkansas 43. Went to this last year, had a blast.
Oh, good.
So...
I take us off topic.
And there you go again.
Rock swap. You take in one of your rocks and you trade it with someone for one of theirs?
I don't know if they'll really let you do that or if they want money to change hands.
All right.
But if you have cool rocks, I'd certainly take them with me.
Okay.
Songwriter Candy Lee is going to be one of the performers at Terra Studios Fall Music Festival.
Be a lot of fun.
Noon to 6 today at the Art Studio in Durham. Other performers include Bryn Bowen Cox, Marshall Mitchell, Kurt Lanier, Gary Schmitz, and more. And it's free, but they're accepting donations for Meals on Wheels.
Great.
Noise is off. 2 o'clock. Theater Squared at the Nadine Baum Studios in Fayetteville, $24 and up. If you never listen to me about anything else, really go to this show. You saw it.
I'm seeing it this afternoon.
You're seeing it this afternoon. Okay. Stomp concludes its run at the Walton Arts Center.
I'm seeing Stomp this afternoon. I've seen Noises Off.
He's more confused than we are.
I saw Noises Off last Sunday.
Okay.
And it was hilarious. I'm seeing Stomp this Sunday.
Today?
Yes.
Okay.
Today, this afternoon.
Okay, so what did you think of Noises Off?
I thought it was hilarious. Much more sense than I am making this morning.
Okay.
Good grief.
He hasn't had coffee yet. There's just a water bottle sitting here. I'm just making excuses for him. Stomp, 2 o'clock, Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. And at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale, The Queen of Bingo, a comedy about two sisters who live for the game. Tickets are $16 and up, and you can find out more at 751-5441.
All right. Thank you, Becca.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Weekend Ozarks Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And this is also KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Oak Grove.
Oak Grove. I've heard of it. Where is it?
Northern Carroll County. It's a little south of Blue Eye. And, of course, Blue Eye straddles the line. There's a Blue Eye, Arkansas, and Blue Eye, Missouri. So if you were to head from Green Forest north toward Missouri, you'd go through Oak Grove pretty quickly.
All right. Well, on your Sunday drive.
That's right. It'd be a perfect place to take a Sunday drive.
All right.
I should say that later today I'm going to go see Stomp at Walton Arts Center. I've never seen
How
Stomp.
How exciting.
I'm excited.
Yeah. I saw it when it was here in 08.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
I remember seeing them for the first time years ago on some late night show. I don't know if it was Carson or Jay Leno or whatever, and was just blown away and said, someday I'm going to see them. So today, finally.
Well, you'll have fun. I myself am going to enjoy a quiet Sunday afternoon. Stomp won't be quiet.
No. If you want a quiet Sunday, Stomp's not the prescription, but I'm looking forward to it. But a quiet Sunday sounds nice as well.
All right. Well, happy Sunday.